The First Christmas Tree by Henry Van Dyke, recorded by Kenneth Rowling. Chapter 1. The Call of the Woodsman. The day before Christmas, in the year of our Lord, 722. Broad snow meadows glistening white along the banks of the River Mossel. Pallid hillsides blooming with mystic roses, where the glow of the setting sun still lingered upon them. An arch of clearest, faintest azure bending overhead. In the center of the aerial landscape of the massive walls of the cloister of Falzel, gray to the east, purple to the west, silence over all. A gentle, eager, conscious stillness diffused through the air like perfume, as if earth and sky were hushing themselves to hear the voice of the river faintly murmuring down the valley. In the cloister, too, there was silence at the sunset hour. All day long there had been a strange and joyful stir among the nuns. A breeze of curiosity and excitement had swept along the corridors and through every quiet cell. The elder sisters, the provost, the deaconess, the stewardess, the portress with her huge bunch of keys jingling at her girdle, had been hurrying to and fro, busied with household cares. In the huge kitchen there was a bustle of hospitable preparation. The little bandy-legged dogs that kept the spits turning before the fires had been trotting steadily for many an hour, until their tongues hung out for want of breath. The big black pots swinging from the cranes had bubbled and gurgled and shaken and sent out puffs of appetizing steam. Saint Martha was in her element. It was a field day for her virtues. The younger sisters, the pupils of the convent, had forsaken their Latin books and their embroidery frames, their manuscripts and their miniatures, and fluttered through the halls in little flocks, like merry snowbirds, all in black and white, chattering and whispering together. This was no day for tedious task work, no day for grammar or arithmetic, no day for picking out illuminated letters in red and gold on stiff parchment, or patiently chasing intricate patterns over thick cloth with the slow needle. It was a holiday. A famous visitor had come to the convent. It was Winfried of England, whose name in the Roman tongue was Boniface, and whom men called the Apostle of Germany. A great preacher, a wonderful scholar, he had written a Latin grammar himself. Think of it. And he could hardly sleep without a book under his pillow. But more than all, a great and daring traveler, a venturesome pilgrim, a high priest of romance. He had left his home and his fair estate in Wessex. He would not stay in the rich monastery of Nuttishell, even though they had chosen him as the abbot. He had refused a bishopric at the court of King Karl. Nothing would content him but to go out into the wild woods and preach to the heathen. Up and down through the forests of Hesse and Thuringia, and along the borders of Saxony, he had wandered for years, with a handful of companions, sleeping under the trees, crossing mountains and marshes, now here, now there, never satisfied with ease and comfort, always in love with hardship and danger. What a man he was, fair and slight, but straight as a spear and strong as an oaken staff. His face was still young. The smooth skin was bronzed by wind and sun. His gray eyes, clear and kind, flashed like fire when he spoke of his adventures and of the evil deeds of the false priests with whom he had contended. What tales he told that day! Not of miracles wrought by sacred relics, nor of courts and councils and splendid cathedrals, though he knew much of these things, and had been at Rome and received the Pope's blessing. But today He had spoken of long journeys by sea and land, of perils by fire and flood, of wolves and bears, and fierce snowstorms and black nights in the lonely forest, of dark altars,
of heathen gods,
and weird bloody sacrifices, and narrow escapes from wandering savages. The little novices had gathered around him, and their faces had grown pale and their eyes bright as they listened with parted lips, entranced in admiration, twining their arms about one another's shoulders and holding closely together, half in fear, half in delight. The older nuns had turned from their tasks and paused in passing by to hear the pilgrim's story. Too well they knew the truth of what he spoke. Many a one among them had seen the smoke rising from the ruins of her father's roof. Many a one had a brother far away in the wild country, to whom her heart went out night and day, wondering if he were still among the living. But now the excitements of that wonderful day were over. The hours of the evening meal had come. The inmates of the cloister were assembled in the refectory. On the day sat stately Abbess Adula, daughter of King Dagobert, looking a princess indeed, in her violet tunic, with the hood and cuffs of her long white robe trimmed with fur, and a snowy veil resting like a crown on her snowy hair. At her right hand was the honored guest, and at her left hand her grandson, the young Prince Gregor, a big, manly boy, just returned from school. The long, shadowy hall, with its dark brown raters and beams, the double rows of nuns with their pure veils and fair faces, the ruddy flow of the slanting sunbeams striking upwards through the tops of the windows and painting a pink glow high up on the walls. It was all as beautiful as a picture, and as silent. For this was the rule of the cloister, that at the table all should sit in stillness for a little while, and then one should read aloud while the rest listened. "It is the turn of my grandson to read today," said the abbess to Winfried. "We shall see how much he has learned in the school. Read, Gregor. The place in the book is marked." The tall lad rose from his seat and turned the pages of the manuscript. It was a copy of Jerome's version of the scriptures in Latin, and the marked place was in the letter of St. Paul to the Ephesians. The passage where he describes the preparation of the Christian as the arming of a warrior for glorious battle. The young voice rang out clearly, rolling the sonorous words without slip or stumbling to the end of the chapter. Winfried listened, smiling. "My son," said he, as the reader paused, "that was bravely read. Understandest thou what thou readest?" "Surely, father," answered the boy. "It was taught me by the masters at Trevet, and we have read this epistle clear through from beginning to end, so that I almost know it by heart." Then he began again to repeat the passage, turning away from the page as if to show his skill, but Winfried stopped him with a friendly lifting of the hand. "No, no, my son, that was not my meaning. When we pray, we speak to God. When we read, it is God who speaks to us. I ask whether thou hast heard what he has said to thee in thine own words, in the common speech. Come, give us again the message of the warrior and his armor and his battle, in the mother tongue, so that all can understand it." The boy hesitated, blushed, stammered. Then he came round to Winfried's seat, bringing the book. "Take the book, my father," he cried, "and read it for me. I cannot see the meaning plain, though I love the sound of the words. Religion I know, and the doctrines of our faith, and the life of priests and nuns in the cloister, for which my grandmother designs me, though it likes me little. And fighting I know, and the life of warriors and heroes, for I have read of it in Virgil and the ancients, and heard a bit from the soldiers at Trevet. And I would fain taste more of it, for it likes me much. But how the two lives fit together, or what need there is of armor for a clerk in holy orders, I can never see. Tell me the meaning, for if there is a man in all the world that knows it, I am sure it is none other than thou. So Winfried took the book and closed it, clasping the boy's hand with his own. Let us first dismiss the others to their vespers, said he, lest they should be weary. A sign from the abbess, a chanted benediction, a murmuring of sweet voices, and a soft rustling of many feet over the rushes on the floor. The gentle tide of noise flowed out through the doors and ebbed away down the corridors. The three at the head of the table were left alone in the darkening room. Then Winfried began to translate the parable of the soldier into the realities of life. At every turn, he knew how to flash a new light into the picture out of his own experience. He spoke of the combat with self, and of the wrestling with dark spirits in solitude. He spoke of the demons that men had worshipped for centuries in the wilderness, and whose malice they invoked against the stranger who ventured into the gloomy forest. Gods, they called them, and told strange tales of their dwelling among the impenetrable branches of the oldest trees, and in the caverns of the shaggy hills, of their riding on the wind horses, and hurling spears of lightning against their foes. Gods they were not, but foul spirits of the air, rulers of the darkness. Was there not glory and honor in fighting with them? In daring their anger under the shield of faith, in putting them to flight with the sword of truth. What better adventure could a brave man ask than to go forth against them, and wrestle with them, and conquer them? Look you, my friends, said Winfried, how sweet and peaceful is this convent tonight, on the eve of the nativity of the Prince of Peace. It is a garden full of flowers in the heart of winter. A nest among the branches of a great tree shaken by the winds, a still haven on the edge of a tempestuous sea. And this is what religion means for those who are chosen and called to quietude and prayer and meditation. But out yonder, in the wide forest, who knows what storms are raving tonight in the hearts of men? Though all the woods are still. Who knows what haunts of wrath and cruelty and fear are closed tonight against the advent of the Prince of Peace? And shall I tell you what religion means to those who are called and chosen to dare and to fight and to conquer the world for Christ? It means to launch out into the deep. It means to go against the strongholds of the adversary. It means to struggle to win an entrance for their master everywhere. What helmet is strong enough for this strife save the helmet of salvation? What breastplate can guard a man against these fiery darts but the breastplate of righteousness? What shoes can stand the wear of these journeys but the preparation of the gospel of peace? Shoes, he cried again, and laughed as if a sudden thought had struck him. He thrust out his foot, covered with a heavy cowhide boot, laced high about his leg with thongs of skin. See here, how a fighting man of the cross is shod. I have seen the boots of the Bishop of Tours, white kid, broidered with silk. A day in the bogs would tear them to shreds. I have seen the sandals that the monks use on the high roads, yes, and worn them. 10 pair of them have I worn out and thrown away in a single journey. Now I shoe my feet with the toughest hides, hard as iron. No rock can cut them, no branches can tear them. Yet more than 1 pair of these I have outworn, and many more shall I outwear ere my journeys are ended. And I think, if God is gracious to me, that I shall die wearing them. Better so than in a soft bed with silken coverings. The boots of a warrior, a hunter, a woodsman, these are my preparation of the gospel of peace. "Come, Gregor," he said, laying his brown hand on the youth's shoulder. "Come, wear the forester's boots with me. This is the life to which we are called. Be strong in the Lord, a hunter of demons, a subduer of the wilderness, a woodsman of the faith. Come." The boy's eyes sparkled. He turned to his grandmother. She shook her head vigorously. "Nay, father," she said, "draw not the lad away from my side with these wild words. I need him to help me with my labors, to cheer my old age. Do you need him more than the master does?" asked Winfried. "And will you take the wood that is fit for a bow to make a distaff?" "But I fear for the child. Thy life is too hard for him. He will perish with hunger in the woods." "Once," said Winfried, smiling, "we were camped by the bank of the river Oru. The table was spread for the morning meal, but my comrades cried that it was empty. The provisions were exhausted. We must go without breakfast, and perhaps starve before we could escape from the wilderness." While they complained, a fish hawk flew up from the river with flapping wings, and let fall a great pike in the midst of the camp. There was food enough and to spare. Never have I seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. "But the fierce pagans of the forest," cried the abbess, "they may pierce the boy with their arrows, or dash out his brains with their axes. He is but a child, too young for the dangers of strife." "A child in years," replied Winfried, "but a man in spirit. And if the hero must fall early in the battle, he wears the brighter crown, not a leaf withered, not a flower fallen." The aged princess trembled a little. She drew Gregor close to her side and laid her hand gently on his brown hair. "I am not sure that he wants to leave me yet. Besides, there is no horse in the stable to give him now, and he cannot go as befits the grandson of a king." Gregor looked straight into her eyes. "Grandmother," said he, "dear grandmother, if thou wilt not give me a horse to ride with this man of God, I will go with him afoot." The fields around lay bare to the moon.